Rubinett versus Sharon Rubinett. Certainly. Mr. Clunch?
May it please the justices. You know, let me begin by telling you a very short story that gives you sort of where we're coming from. About 2 years ago, Dr. Rubinett came into my office and he gave me this scenario. He says, I have a little boy, 6 years old. My wife is an airline hostess. She flies 3 or 4 days a week. She's gone from 12 to 14 days a month. I have been very close to my child because in that 6 months, in that 6 years, I've cared for him. Every day, you know, I'm here, she's gone, I love it, I love my little boy. What chance do I have to be managing conservator of my child? And I thought about that a little bit, and I said, now, if you'd come in and you told me you flew that airplane 12 to 14 days a month, and you want to be managing conservator of that child, my answer is to you, you don't have a chance to do that, and it's not very good. So the reverse of that is, your wife, flying 13 to 14 days a month, should not have a very good opportunity to be the managing conservator, and you ought to go ahead and ask for managing conservatorship of your child. So that's where we stood, and we went to the court on that. The only time he had not been with his child was one time that had a disagreement, and the wife had left with the child for about a week, took the child, didn't tell him where it was, and he found it later. Follow that same scenario at the second party. Again, took the child. He's never denied her any access to the child. And so when we go to court, we're trying a lawsuit. And the first thing we do is have just the filing of the petitions, a temporary hearing, nothing unusual about that. And we come back a little later because we've divided up. Even before we came here, we'd been going on a schedule of dividing time before the court over there. And so this time when we come back to court, it's over a rather minor thing. My client had not been away from his child very long. The child's 7 years old at that time. He wanted to be told good night. And so my client says, I'll buy you a cell phone. You tell your baby good night each night. Well, that caused a...
All this is in the record?
Yes, I think these things are in the record, John.
Because we can't consider anything that's not actually in the record.
Well, it's all in the testimony, Judge. It's in the record. I would not recite these things in the testimony. But at any rate, what we did was by a telephone, and that worked out wonderfully well. No more. And the reason I bring this up, Judge Justice, is that in the record we talk about attorney's fees later on, and I want to know why. Because there was no disagreement about the property. That had all been agreed to when we went to trial. There was no disagreement. We were going to just go by whatever the court said in child support for either party. And so the court then, at the end of the trial, awarded $7,500 attorney's fees over to the other side. And I'm saying, what did I do wrong? What did we do wrong? We simply had a divorce trial in which we asked for custody. Does that mean that each time you go to trial, if you feel like you should ask for custody and you don't, you're going to be penalized in that manner, $7,500 or something else that you might fear? It could have been more. And so that's one of the things that came to my attention. Now back into the trial, and in my brief, I want my man to be appointed a joint managing conservatorship after that trial, and I believe the evidence in the record reflects that, because if you start with the people that came to trial, I think this testimony that I mentioned is in there, that he kept the child, and that we had a social study, and I believe the social report is in there done by Susan Goldstein, and you might draw the conclusion that if you just read the briefs, that somehow she found my client unfitting in some way, and that's not true if you read that social report. She says that both parents are excellent parents, and that in this case, I believe she concludes by saying, I wish I could say to the court, just leave everything like it is. Don't name anybody joint managing servitor. But she does draw one conclusion that leads to problem, Susan Goldstein, in that report. She drew the conclusion that somehow, because he had asked for equal, because he had asked for managing conservatorship and the right to have the standard possession schedule, that that meant she couldn't see the child because she was fly. Well, now, in family law, we have schedules that are part of, and I've attached one here for people who are in an airline business. Now, I would assume that a social worker doing schedules would know that, but she used that as the crux to say that my client somehow wanted an advantage over his ex-wife, and we didn't want that at all. Now, going through the testimony about what happened and who cared for the child, I'd like to point out that the two witnesses that the wife brought to testify at this trial, he both ended up by saying, I don't know Dr. Rubinette. I've never met him, and therefore they wouldn't have much to say about him. I brought several witnesses, I think there were six altogether, that knew all parties to this case. And just to summarize some very shortly, this Iris Kirkendall was a person that he went he had known by sharing tickets to the Texas Rangers ball game. Just so happened she was also a person who made her living as a counselor. But she was not there to testify other than as his friend. And she said she had observed this child with his father on numerous occasions. And she thought he was an excellent father, the best she had ever seen. Very high praise. And why? Because if he had to tell his children or his child something and to scold him, he called him aside and talked to him softly. Now, I don't think that Iris really knew Sharon. I want to make that clear to the court. But Greg Weed was a man that knew my client for 30 years. He was a doctor, just like a doctor of veterinary medicine, just like my client. They went to dinner once every week during most of their life. He knew this child since they were born. He knew Sharon. He said he went to dinner with this man. He testified in the record he went to dinner with this man and had the child with him. And he thought that when he saw him changing that child and taking care of him, he noticed that, and he thought he was close to and a very good father to this child. And then there was Brett Bearden, and Brett was just a guy that knew my client for about 20 years, I think he said, and just knew him socially, working in the Little Leagues and that sort of thing. And in response to a question directed to him by the other attorney about whether or not he was a good father and how he could tell he was such a good father, he made this response. He said, when you're in a room, and this is, again, Justice, is in the testimony, when you're in a room and a child comes into the room, both parents are there, and 9 out of 10 times he goes to one parent, he says, I kind of assume that he's closer to that parent. And that's what he was talking about in this case with Dr. Rubinette. There was a two ladies he brought in who knew both, who had worked for him. One had worked, one was a past employee, one was a present employee. Both of them knew Sharon. They don't say ugly things about her. And I didn't bring people in to testify to say ugly things about Sharon Rubinette. I brought people in to talk about the role of Dr. Rubinette as a father. And each one of those and everybody in there says that Jeff Rubinette was closer to his son than his mother. Now, why? Well, it's rather obvious if he'd been there for all those years taking care of the child that he might have a closer bond with the child than with Mr. Rubinette, who's gone from 12 to 14 to 15 days out of the week. Incidentally, in the testimony, Mrs. Rubinette says she could change. She had 20 years flight seniority with Delta as a stewardess, and she could change her schedule, and she could accommodate that. Now, for those reasons, I was rather upset when I get a judgment that comes down that not only is he the not the father with the right to establish domicile, that all of the rights of a joint managing servitor, the main ones, are given, quote, exclusively to the mother. That's in the judgment. Now, how can you give those rights if you're trying to work under the code that says, so far as practical, you will encourage the rights of both parents? Now, and what happens as a practical matter if Mrs. Rubinette is flying somewhere up in the sky and Mr. Rubinette is here with Josh, as he would be, and Josh is the little boy's name, I'm sorry, and the little boy gets ill and needs emergency treatment? Do we get on the telephone and start trying to track down Mrs. Rubinette in the skies or wherever she is, or at Atlanta? She has to fly from here to Atlanta because the flight is out of Atlanta. Delta does this schedule. So these problems concern me greatly, that because one of the things this man did in this decree, he's denied, she has exclusive rights to determine educational benefits and where you'll go to school, that sort of thing. Well, who did all that while she was going on before? He did. And this was a man, and how many fathers do you get that do this? He sold his separate property, took $17,500, and bought a tomorrow's future at the University of Texas for his son. In other words, guaranteeing his son education. And then in the court decree, the court addresses that and says, well, you'll have to account for that now every year to Mrs. Rubinette. Now, wait a minute.
Wait. All I read that it says is that in the decree, he's going to provide the documentation regarding the fund. And to me, it doesn't limit anything that he can do. It doesn't require him to do anything in the future. I'm thinking that it's so that the wife can say, okay, the fund requires $50,000, and he's put in $40,000. And so I need to be planning on how to put in another 10. I mean, I don't read this sentence here. It says he's got to do it within 15 days, and it sounds like to me once he gives her the information about what's there in writing, it's over.
Justice McCoy, why should my client have to give any accounting of any kind?
So that she can plan for whatever needs to be done to complete the vesting in the tomorrow fund for the child so it can get a college education, if anything else needs to be done.
Justice, I respectfully would disagree with you on that. Why couldn't he do the same thing for anything else he'd done? Give his income each month or something like that. You know, and I just don't think that's the right thing for a man to have to do that's donated his funds for separate property. If she wanted to call him, he would probably say, okay, here's where you are. If you want to give money, she's free to give money, of course, but she didn't do that before, Justice. He did. You know, he did.
Okay, all I'm saying is I think all he has to do is let her know how much money's been contributed to the tomorrow fund so that she can then complete whatever needs to be done.
Well, Justice, we know what the sum was, $17,500, and I think you could call the University of Texas and find out. I need to finish a couple other things here. About to run out of time, and I want to say some things here, obviously. But one of the things, I think I have spoken to you about the main thing I want to address here. Have you looked at the schedule? Have you looked at the times that my client has a Saturday night? It has none by that schedule. None during the week. The only Saturday night he'd have is a 10-day period during his only period of solo possession, that maybe he goes on vacation. Now, that's, I'm telling you, if you look at the schedule, he has to turn the child over on Saturday night. Every Saturday night. Does he have the child on Father's Day weekend exclusively? No. Now, those rights and that visitation schedule is abysmal. He doesn't have any time. This is a man that used to take, if you read the record, you know, the boy to the ball game with him and watch the ball game. Used to take him to other activities with him. Where does he do that now, on Friday night alone? Well, you know, is that in, and going back to square one, is all that in the best interest of this little boy? The best interest of this little boy would have been shared, and that's what we're supposed to be here about, would have been shared if they had made, if this court had made all those, at first it made him the managing conservator, but if not that, all those rights, shared rights. Do you think in family law that I sit out there and tell people, let's get all the rights? That wouldn't, that's not the best way to raise a child under that code. The best way is to say you each have rights. Thank you, Jeff.
Ms. Harris?
May it please the court. The appellant started out with a story, and I wanted to clarify a few facts that presented in that case. When you typically deal with family law cases, divorce battles, and custody battles, you usually have some unsavory characteristics for one or both of the parents. In this case, we do not. Neither parent are drug addicted. There is no abuse allegations from either parent. There is no alcohol allegations. What we have here is one of the most difficult cases you can come across in family law, a case with two fairly competent parents who are both concerned and love their child. That is what makes this case all the more difficult, because the court in this case, as within every family law case, must apply the best interest standard. As we all know, the best interest standard is not clearly defined. It's something we know, it's something we understand, but not something that can be clearly articulated, and not something that the facts can always clearly specify. Now, the appellant in this case has brought forth five specific issues that they have contention with. The first being the reason, the fact that Mom, Ms. Rubinette, was designated the primary parent, or the parent with the right to designate the primary residence of the child. From Sharon Goldstein's social study report, which is found in the record on page 92, also from Judge Wells' findings of fact and conclusion of law that were filed with this court, it is clear that both the judge and Ms. Goldstein believe Mr. Rubinette is a good and competent parent. Their concern lies with the fact that Mr. Rubinette may be overzealous in some situations. It's clear from the record that he has oftentimes alienated Mom from their son. It is clear from the record that small issues become large issues. Mr. Quanch was discussing the issue of a cell phone. That actually became a big problem that required a hearing and required court's intervention so that the parties could utilize that particular cell phone appropriately without putting the child in the middle. These parties are good parents, but unfortunately, they don't have the ability to communicate well with each other. And that was the concern of the court and Ms. Goldstein. Ms. Goldstein stated clearly in her social study that she believed that the father had inflated his own personal value to the son's life and deflated the value of the mother's life in the son's life. One of the goals of the family court system, one of the goals of a family court judge when making these determinations, is trying to put the child in a situation with a parent that is going to continue to foster a relationship with the other parent. Now, if you have a father who is telling the social worker, the caseworker, that his role in his son's life is far more important than that of the mother, that would give great pause to a trial court. It would certainly imply that that father may not be the parent who can continually foster a continuous and strong relationship with the other parent. Judge Wells, in her ruling, also allocated the exclusive rights, several of the exclusive rights, to Mom. The appellant was discussing earlier the medical rights. The medical right that was given to Mom exclusively was the right to make decisions regarding invasive medical treatment.
I'm sorry to interrupt you. Back up for a minute. How does this order solve the problem that you've been articulating?
The largest problem, obviously, Your Honor, is the fact that the court was concerned about who was going to foster a more continuous relationship. Judge Wells was able to do that in her order by allowing Mom to be primary but dividing a visitation schedule so that the child spends four nights a week with mom and 3 nights a week with dad every week. In addition to the standard holidays, Father's Day, Mr. Rubinette gets Father's Day, of course. Now, he only gets, instead of the overnight from 9 to 6 p.m., mom gets the same on Mother's Day. Spring break is divided in the way that a normal standard order is divided. Thanksgiving and Christmas is as well. Mr. Rubinette actually is awarded additional time for the Hanukkah season. And in addition, the parties added in special provisions for New Year's Eve. So there's even a holiday that's not typically addressed where the parties retain possession of the child. The visitation schedule certainly deviates from the standard visitation schedule. But the law certainly allows broad discretion for the trial court when determining what is in the best interest of the child.
One thing that concerns me that Mr. Klontsch said was that his client isn't willing to discuss something as fundamental as the ability to pay for college with the child's mother. Is this typical of the relationship between the parties that... That one of the parties or both of the parties won't even discuss something that fundamental with the other?
Yes, Your Honor, it is. From the reporter's record, it's clear that the parties, during out their marriage, kept separate bank accounts, kept separate financial information, and did not discuss with each other those financial situations. It was a very much, throughout the course of their marriage, hers, his. The child was the only thing that was ours, per se. The father is a veterinarian. He has his own separate property that he had when he came into the marriage, obviously. He did sell a building, which resulted in the $17,500, and he did, thankfully, deposit that into the Texas Tomorrow Fund to provide for his son's college education. And as Justice McCoy clearly noted during the appellant's argument, Judge Wells did not give the mother any kind of control, any kind of capability to adjust the account, simply notification that the account still exists. So that when her child gets ready to, when their child gets ready to start college and the check has to be written, she's not going to be shocked to find out that that original $17,500 disappeared years before and she had not made adequate preparations to take care of the financial needs for her child's college education. I agree with Judge Wells and Justice McCoy's interpretation that it's simply a notification measure so that this mother can properly prepare to help support the son's college education. With the division of rights and duties, the significant point that I wanted to make in clarification, obviously the right, the exclusive right to invasive medical procedures does not cover emergency treatment. If this son was with the father and the mother was in the sky on a plane and there was an emergency, obviously he has the right to be able to take his son to seek emergency medical treatment. Every parent has that right at all times. What this right specifically deals with are those non-emergency issues. If the son needed reconstructive surgery on the sinuses or dental surgery, things of that nature, which the mother would certainly be here and available to make those decisions. The mother has been a flight attendant for 20 years. She was a flight attendant before she met Mr. Rubinette and throughout the term of their marriage. Her schedule has never significantly deviated. She does have seniority because of her years as a flight attendant, and so therefore she flies Thursday, Friday, and Saturday of each week. And the reason that schedule was put into place was Mr. Rubinette's veterinarian practice allowed him flexibility on Thursdays, Fridays, and Saturdays. During the course of their marriage, they also employed a nanny, Miss Emma Cooper, who testified in the record. So even when Miss Rubinette was flying those 12 to 14 days a month, there was an employee that was there to assist Mr. Rubinette in helping raise his child. So though Mr. Rubinette was certainly an involved parent, certainly a caring parent, certainly a parent that is concerned about the best interest of his child, he was not the sole provider at any time during this child's life. During the week, mom was there to assist, and on the weekends when mom flew, Miss Emma Cooper, the nanny, was there to assist. No one is trying to diminish dad's involvement. What the court, and as a concern to Miss Goldstein, was trying to ensure was that this relationship can continue to be fostered between both parents, So that the child doesn't feel stuck in the middle and guilty because he likes both parents, because he enjoys spending time with both parents. Now, the appellant argued that he has a significantly reduced amount of time with the child. That is true. When parents separate or get divorced, you're not going to be able to spend every single day with the child. It's just the way that it is. But with the visitation schedule that Judge Wells outlined, Miss Rubinette, if you count the days, gets 208 overnight.
...108 before, and he got 365. So she's gone from 208 to 208, and he's gone from 365 to 162.
That is correct, Your Honor, with the addition of additional holiday time.
Right.
And I believe that one of the reasons for that, and once again, and I hate to continue to harp on the same motive, is to continue the fostering of the relationship between the parties. Because regardless of the number of days, the important issue is the relationship between the parents. It could be, you know, 10 to 1. But if the parent who is in primary care, who is with the child the majority number of days, is not going to continue to foster a relationship with the other parent, then you're doing a disservice to the child. Parental alienation will evolve, and that is certainly not in the best interest of the child. One of the additional issues that the appellant brought up was the award of attorney's fees. Mom was awarded $7,500 in attorney's fees. The appellant claims that this is an abuse of discretion and against the public policy of the state of Texas because he was acting under Texas Family Code 6.008, which deals with the division of property in a dissolution of marriage. Well, with every dissolution of marriage where there is a child custody case, obviously there is a SAPSR included, a suit affecting the parent-child relationship. The wording of the judgment and the way Judge Wells worded it in her original judgment before it was rendered into formal writing clearly showed that she was awarding the attorney's fees as a reasonable cost and necessities, as you would in a SAPSR type case. Then in the record, both attorneys asked for attorney's fees. Mr. Quanch, who was the trial counsel for the appellant, he stood and requested attorney's fees on a record and put on the proper testimony for them as well. The trial counsel for the appellee, Ms. Rubinette, stood, asked for attorney's fees, and put on the proper testimony that is required as well. Both attorneys asked for the same amount, $10,000. In this case, the judge determined that it was in the best interest of the child and that there was good cause for attorney's fees to be awarded to Mom. One of the additional factors that may have gone into that determination had to do with the child support and the way the judge ordered the child support in this particular case. Now, the appellant has made no arguments in regards to the child support, but I do believe it gives some additional basis to the $7,500 attorney's fees award. In this case, the appellant is only required to pay the appellee $75 per month for child support, and considering that he is a veterinarian, that's a rather nominal figure. He is also required to reimburse Mom $75 per month for medical insurance. Now, two times a year, Judge Wells ordered that the appellant is required to pay Mom a lump sum amount, $500 on February 1st and $500 on August 1st, obviously for school necessities and school clothing and things of that nature. The only additional award that was given to the appellee in the form of money or child support was that in extracurriculars. The father is responsible for paying for 100% of all extracurricular activities. But considering,
is this an award, or was this that they had worked out, which is what I understood, everything had been worked out except the child question?
That is incorrect, Your Honor. When they appeared and presented themselves to the court, they announced ready for trial and stated that they had determined all the property division issues, nothing in regards to the child support, or I'm sorry, to child issues.
Okay.
Conservatorship and access and anything having to do with the child is very difficult for these parties to reach an agreement on. The division of the property was fairly simple because most of the property in the marriage was separate property to begin with, so obviously that went to husband. Mom kept her retirement fund. Dad kept his retirement fund. There was nothing to particularly fight over. They kept debts in each other's names. So when they came to the court, they were looking to Judge Wells to make all of the decisions in regards to a SAPSR and not really a dissolution of marriage because they had actually already handled that. The last issue that the appellant brought before the court was, of course, the Texas Tomorrow Fund. We've spoken about it earlier and in somewhat detail. The order of Judge Wells specifically states that he is only to provide reporting information. The appellee has no care and control.
One time, correct?
No, Your Honor, it is not. It states that at any time he receives financial information, he is to provide that information to the appellee within 15 days of its receipt.
Is there not more than just one paragraph?
There is only one paragraph, Your Honor, and that's located...
Page 8 or 9?
Yes.
Oh, here it is on page 8.
Yes, sir. One paragraph. And that paragraph allows him to simply provide financial information to his last known address that he has for Ms. Rubinette, once again, so that she has the proper information to prepare for the child's future college education. It is clear from the record, from Ms. Goldstein's social study, and from the evidence presented before the court in Judge Wells' findings of facts and conclusions of law, that none of the decisions that the appellant is objecting to violate public policy or in any way an abuse of the court's discretion. In order for the court to abuse the this court to find that Judge Wells abused her discretion, it would have to be clear that she acted arbitrarily, without any information, without any evidence. And there is clear evidence to be presented. I see that my time has expired. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court, back to our situation of Sharon Rubinette flying across somewhere, God knows where, I don't know, in her flight, and Mr. Rubinette here, and the child gets injured. I think you were told that he had the right to make emergency medical treatment, and I don't believe that is the case. I believe it says that as a parent, he does not have that right on page 4.
It's already on page 3.
Of the decree, and that's on the decree is page is exhibit 1 to my brief, and on page 4 it says that during his respective periods of possession, Jeff Rubinette, as parent, joint, managing conservator, shall have the following rights and duties: the duty of care, control, protection, and reasonable discipline of the child, the duty to support the child, including providing the child with clothing, food, shelter, and medical and dental care not involving an invasive procedure. That leaves Mr. Rubinette here on the ground trying to do the best he can with a doctor saying, let me see your order.
What about page 3 where it says the right to consent to medical and dental and surgical treatment during an emergency involving an immediate danger to the health and safety of the child?
Yes, Your Honor, I'm sorry.
And the right to manage the estate of the child to the extent the estate has been created by the parent or the parent's family. And that those address both of the issues you've raised.
All right, Your Honor. Right before that, it is ordered that at all times Sharon M. Rubinette, as parent, joint, managing conservator, shall have the following rights.
Well, you were talking about an emergency when she was flying off to God knows where.
Well, there's a conflict then, because doesn't she have the exclusive right up above?
Well, I don't want to argue with you about it, Jim. I just wanted to say that that's what I'm reading the order, and that's what I understand the order to say.
Okay. Well, I understood the order to say that she had the exclusive right to do the medical, and that he did, and I was concerned that that would mean
sure.
that he wouldn't have it, and that's all I'm saying.
Sure.
Yeah, I can be wrong. You well know that. Okay. But now, there is something, though, that we didn't bring to the court, and I need to bring it to the court, because in family law, we get this all the time. And it's true in this court. I raised the last point, and I said that there was no pleading to support the judgment rendered. No pleading to support it. It was nowhere asked in the pleading for any of those exclusive rights. And I believe that to be true. And if there are no rights, I think the response to that in the brief was, well, I take a very narrow view of that. Well, the view I take is what the rules of civil procedure say. And when I'm standing in front of a judge and I ask for some of those things, those family judges do say, where did you plead that? And it's not pled. So I'd ask you to look at that. I don't think the judgment is supported by the pleadings, especially when you're talking about the rights of the child and the exclusive rights. I've taken enough of your time. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Your case is submitted. you want to take a break.
I'm okay. Well, Allie's not here, so.
Oh.